Well, we're going to get started. Welcome everybody to this latest edition of the Aerospace and Defense Forum program for the year. I'm your host, Gerardo Brusi. I'm chairman of the Ventura County chapter of the Aerospace and Defense Forum, and also director of BrainSpark Consulting, a program and project management consultancy. This morning's topic is on the future of flight, from electric aviation to supersonic, suborbital, and beyond. And our guest presenter today is Dr. Anita Sengupta. Before we go to the meeting, to the presentation, just a few things on the forum and some housekeeping items to go through. Ivan, can we go to the next slide, please? There you go. So the Aerospace and Defense Forum is, is the purpose is to really to connect people in the aerospace and defense industry to meet each other, share ideas, information, collaborate on projects, and basically support each other. Currently, there are 9 chapters, the Ventura chapter being one of the latest ones. And we're currently conducting about 3 webinars per month. Normally, when we meet in person, there's one meeting in person per month. Right now, with the current conditions, we're trying to keep up by doing a little bit more online. There's over 2,500 professionals in the forum, so I encourage you to join and connect with your peers. Next slide, please. Just a little bit more about the new Ventura chapter. For those of you who don't know, Ventura is this part of the 101 between LA and Santa Barbara, but it's also home to more than 30 aerospace companies, and we are growing the chapter. We already have 3 events this year with Dan Curry, who did all the special effects for Star Trek, The Next Generation, with Richard Abulafia, who is an expert in aviation, and Leon Alkali, who is a JPL fellow. The chapter steering committee is myself, Michael Sponsillo, Robert Gleason, David Conrad, and Brian Baker. Please be hand for them. And next slide, please. Just to let you know, upcoming events, October 15, update on basically unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. October 28, Alex Kurtz on the industry and the middle market view of the aerospace industry. And on November 11, Scott McLaughlin was going to talk about commercial spaceports. So mark your calendars. Next slide, please. Okay, you can also join the forum. You can join the forum for free and get the newsletter. And as long as we're having these Zoom meetings, this will probably still be free. An individual membership, 350 a year, buys you all the access to the forum, plus all the recordings of over, I think it's over 10 years of presentations. It's a really good sort of range of material. There's also corporate memberships, which allow you to bring up to 4 people per company to the events. And there's also sponsorship opportunities to present before the actual presentations. For that, you have to inquire with Ivan at his email below. Next slide, please. Okay, so just a few guidelines for the presentation. Please mute yourself, switch off your video. If you want to, you can go into gallery view so you can see the presentation and post them on screen. And questions, please, on the chat so everybody can see when we do Q&A, that's when we'll be getting the questions. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, that's to the main thing. So, Anita Sengupta, co-founder of Hydroplane, is an aerospace engineer, instrument-rated pilot, rocket scientist, veteran of the space program, and science communicator. She received her master's and PhD in aerospace engineering from the University of California, of Southern California, where she's also a professor of aeronautical engineering at the Viterbi School of Engineering. She teaches and researches technologies for human exploration of Mars, Earth reentry vehicles, and quiet supersonic flight. Next slide, please. I think this is kind of shows across what she has done, and I'll explain that picture in a moment. Dr. Sengupta has developed technologies that have enabled the exploration of Mars, asteroids, and deep space. She started her career at Boeing, building launch vehicles and communication satellites. She then worked at NASA as a NASA engineer for 16 years, developing technologies such as the ion propulsion system for the Dawn mission, which is currently on the asteroid belt, the Cold Atom Laboratory on the International Space Station, which is the coldest place in the universe, and the supersonic parachute that landed the Curiosity rovers on Mars, which is what you see on your screen right now, a picture on the right. That is the actual parachute that Anita worked on, slowing down the rover still attached to the back shell as it is landing on Mars. That's one of the most amazing pictures that I've seen in many, many years. After NASA, she became the senior vice president of systems engineering at Virgin Hyperloop. And this is the test track for Virgin Hyperloop, where she led the development of an entirely new high-speed transportation system based on magnetic levitational propulsion. Her most recent entrepreneurial venture is as co-founder of and CEO of Hyperplane, currently developing carbon-free hydrogen fuel cell technology for aviation, marine, and ground vehicles. So with that, next slide, Ivan. For now, I hand over the presentation to Anita. Anita, thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Let's see if I get this working properly. There was a bit of delay last time I set it up, so. Does it look good, Gerardo? Everything look okay?
Yeah, it looks good for me. To me.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming to listen to my talk this morning and for that comprehensive introduction, Gerardo. And Gerardo did not mention that we worked together at Virgin Hyperloop, so we did actually know each other. And I decided to include some Hyperloop material in the presentation because I felt like it was almost like flight, but on the ground in this case. So I have had a career which has been largely in the space program, and I always like to say that sort of the space program or the NASA mindset brings with it some really unique skills to solve very challenging problems, to engineer complex systems, and to use the discipline of systems engineering to be able to make sort of the impossible possible. And I've tried to expand that into my terrestrial ventures, working with the Hyperloop, electric aviation, eVTOLs, and now with power systems to make aviation more sustainable. I am a very active pilot as well, so I enjoy now being very much in the aviation side of aerospace, although my degrees have always been more on the space side of aerospace. And during the pandemic, I actually took up a new venture, which was to join the Civil Air Patrol, which is part of the United States Air Force, an auxiliary unit, and we also fly small single-engine airplanes for disaster relief purposes. So it's actually been a really fun year exploring new things because of COVID, because I used to travel a lot, and obviously I've stayed primarily stateside during the past, 2 years. So I think aviation is very inspirational because you can go and look back to the first days of powered flight with the Wright brothers. And before they were able to do it, a very famous British physicist, Lord Kelvin, actually said that heavier than air flying machines are impossible. And only a few years later, the Wright brothers demonstrated that it was indeed possible. So just because someone says something isn't possible, doesn't make it so. If you have a great idea, if you believe in your vision or your venture, you should really go off and do it. And I think that's the purpose of these forums, is that we can get together and discuss ideas that we have to advance technology, specifically in the aerospace sector, in different ways. And I enjoyed the summary of your prior speaker, because I'm actually an enormous science fiction fan. I always have been since I was a little kid, definitely more on the Star Trek versus Star War side of things. And I think why I love Star Trek so much is that there's so many examples of technology that we have today that actually came from science fiction. And so you'll see that throughout my presentation, how as an engineer, you could make science fiction a reality. And ultimately, we can create the future that we imagine. And so you see that very much so in the transportation space. And then looking backwards in time, 3000 BC, with the invention of the wheel, all the way, from the Industrial Revolution with trains to personal mobility and city expansion with cars to global commerce and connectivity with aircraft, we can actually see that transportation technology has changed the world over the course of the past several thousand years with regards to economic expansion, human expansion, and human success. And obviously, as we move forward into the next era of spaceflight, that's even more so the case. And so I think that's a really good perspective to have, that if you do work in the aerospace sector, you really are at the forefront of bringing about change to our society in general. And that's a very exciting place to be. But as with many things, they seem to stagnate, and we have to come up with ways to reinvent ourselves as well as to reinvent different sectors. And ultimately, we're at the point now where we need to reinvent transportation. We've got to get away from the same old driving cars on the road and find new ways to solve these challenges. And this is where I like to bring in the systems engineering mindset, because ultimately you have to figure out what is it that your customer wants, and your customer is the traveling public. And so when we think about transportation, the things that matter to us are travel time. Everybody wants to spend as little time as possible on the road or in the air going from point A to point B. Passenger experience. I think nowadays everybody is all about the experience in terms of it being enjoyable, connected, and having access to your internet devices, for example. With regards to the expansion of human society, we have more and more people, which means that congestion is becoming a huge issue, and therefore the capacity for any transportation system has to address existing congestion as well as the growth that's coming around the corner, as is always the case. And from an engineering perspective, when you work in the transportation sector, one of the most important facets of any development is safety. So whatever you develop has to make things safer for people. And I think we see a great impact of, for example, autonomy technologies with cars, which are, largely making driving safer, because you're less likely to have accidents when you have more sensors available to you, and when you have sensors which kick in if something's getting too close, for example, for collision avoidance. But we have to be realistic, and in any business venture and anything that we purchase as a consumer, cost is always a driving factor. And when we think about transportation, there's the individual end user cost, but then there's also the government cost, who has to ultimately implement this new transportation system. And it has to be affordable, because basically the taxpayers will end up footing a large portion of the bill. And I think the biggest challenge of our, or at least my generation and the generation to come, is environmental impact. So when we develop new transportation technologies, we have to think about the way that we're going to make them sustainable in the long run, so that we can address our climate change footprint with regards to carbon output, for example. And scalability, of course, is clear, that you don't want to design something which only works in one city or one environment. It has to be something that can work globally. And so these are the ways that you can use the systems engineering mindset to engineer these new approaches. So what is in the near future of transportation? So I consider this flight, because it moves fast, and so I would say the Hyperloop. And I go back to my inspiration of science fiction here, but first, the origin of the Hyperloop, a lot of people do associate with Elon Musk, is actually the California High-Speed Rail, which has been delayed somewhat, a little bit over budget. And so there was an argument that was made by Elon Musk that, well, in fact, why are we going to go with something which is old technology? We go with something which is new technology. And so he put out a white paper, I think it was in 2013, on how you could have the Hyperloop, which is basically a maglev train operating in a vacuum, which is more environmentally friendly, more energy efficient, and why isn't the government invested in that technology? But Elon Musk didn't invent the Hyperloop. The Hyperloop has existed in the domain of science fiction for many, many decades, in the 20th century, for example. And I go back to my example of the Jetsons, of people traveling in tubes. Not quite the same thing, because that was more propelled with air as opposed to electromagnetically. But you get the idea, that you can see how a lot of these ideas are come up in the imaginations of an author, and then the engineer turns it into reality. And so in the interest of time, I guess I'll try and play this one video. It's not that long. It doesn't seem to be working. I will pass the video. Okay, so what is the Hyperloop? The Hyperloop is essentially a maglev chain, so it's magnetically levitated, electric propelled, but it operates inside of a vacuum tube. And so what that means is that you remove all the air from around the vehicle, and then you therefore mitigate aerodynamic drag. Of course, the vehicle itself has air inside of it, because it's a passenger carrying cabin, so it's like an airplane body, just without the wings. And by the removal of air from around the vehicle inside this tube, you actually mitigate the primary energy loss mechanism as you go increasing the speed, which is aerodynamic drag, because that scales with the speed squared. And so it is a novel idea. It has been demonstrated by several technology companies now. Of course, the one that Gerardo and I used to work at, Virgin Hyperloop, and it has a lot of potential to provide travel in excess of airline speeds, oftentimes two times airline speeds, on the ground to connect people over large distances. But of course, there are challenges associated with the Hyperloop, and the largest one, I would say, probably isn't technology, it's actually cost. So anytime you develop any ground-based transportation system, there's the infrastructure cost, there's the land acquisition, there's the rights of way, in addition to the money to develop the technology, qualify it, and certify it. So I think in general, you see lots of ground-based transportation projects take a really long time because of the cost associated with them. And for anything which is a new technology, you have the added risk associated with that. So I do believe that it will happen. It just will take a few more years before governments, you know, sum up the courage to be able to implement a project like this. But it is something that if you're interested in, there are many technology companies around the world now who are working on this. So I think there's more of a driving force behind it than ever before. But this really comes back to trying to do things differently and using this innovation mindset to solving a lot of problems. And what we're seeing now in the aerospace sector, both aviation as well as space, is that startups, entrepreneurial ventures with small teams of integrated people, oftentimes much younger people, are at the forefront of innovation. We see that with Relativity Space, for example. I'm going to give a shout out to that one because Tim was actually my student, my undergraduate student at USC. So you can see how now startups, not necessarily ones funded by angel investors, but by private capital, are a way to change the face of aerospace. And what technology startups do really well is that they prototype cost efficiently and time efficiently, which allows a demonstration to de-risk a new technology much earlier on. Certainly still capital intensive because you're developing hardware, but definitely moving at a much more rapid pace than the traditional aerospace sector does because they're smaller institutions. They're more agile. They don't have that massive infrastructure associated with decades and decades of operation, which oftentimes does slow down innovation. We have to be realistic about that. And these are some examples of Hyperloop technology startups around the world who are developing technologies to facilitate the Hyperloop, for example. Now, another thing that I love about the transportation sector is finding synergies between different developments that are going on in other places. And if you take a look at self-driving cars, there's been so much work there done in the context of autonomy to be able to do collision avoidance. And a lot of that is largely related to artificial intelligence, which can be implemented for a range of different transportation technologies. And so if you can have more efficient high-speed transportation, you can increase ridership because people feel as though it cuts back on the amount of time that it's taking. You could make it on demand, which once again improves the passenger experience and time efficiency, and you make it fully autonomous, which can make it safer ultimately allow you to travel at fast speeds, for example, the Hyperloop. And so a lot of the technologies that were developed by self-driving car companies, like, for example, Waymo, another one of my colleagues works there, can be implemented to a range of different ground-based technologies. Now, if we go to aviation, obviously we've had autopilots for quite a long time, but their collision avoidance problem is quite different because there aren't as many cars on the ground, there aren't as many planes in the sky as there are cars in the ground. So it's slightly different. And of course, the controls using aerodynamic controls are slightly different as well. So now I'll shift over to air travel. And once again, I go to science fiction for my inspiration and the Jetsons. And in their vision of the future, everybody travels in flying cars, which means a vehicle which I guess can travel on the road as well as travel in the sky. But largely, when we talk about flying cars, we're really talking about vertical takeoff and landing. So you're not going to travel on the road. You're only going to travel in highways in the sky. And the argument behind this is not for every area, but for areas where you have congestion, such as in cities and in suburban environments, where traffic is a nightmare. Los Angeles is a great example of that. So sort of cities that are not as maybe concentrated as New York, but cities which are kind of spread out, such as Los Angeles, would benefit from this type of system. And also recognize that creating a highway in the sky doesn't have the same infrastructure cost as creating, for example, a new light rail or metro system. So it's a way to implement an alternative mode of transportation, which is autonomous, which is shared, but doesn't have the same infrastructure cost. This doesn't in any way, shape, or form replace the need for light rail and metros and subways, but it's another way to augment it. And it's a way to potentially connect people in suburban regions with city centers and even rural regions with city centers without the massive infrastructure costs and the ridership required to justify such a large capital expense. And this market segment, urban air mobility is what it's called, is definitely growing. There's many companies in the space. There's probably over 200 today working on electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. So there is definitely a good business proposition for it. I did spend about 2 years working in this space with a startup when we specifically focused on short range battery powered electric aircraft. So when you focus on energy storage that comes solely from batteries, you are very range limited and you're very payload limited because batteries are, they have very low energy density. But if you're talking about urban air mobility, you're talking about travel between cities. You don't really need a range of anything more than 100 kilometers. Anyway, and that would be able to take you a few trips before you have to charge. But once again, you see here synergies which can exist between electric vehicle ground-based development programs in the context of electric motors and batteries and control technologies and how this could be implemented into a urban air mobility vehicle, which is also an electric vehicle. And both, whether you're talking about charging a battery-powered plane or charging a battery-powered car, you need access to charging stations, you need access to a smart grid, and you can have more of a justification because of the increasing number of use cases to have charging infrastructure installed in city environments and in suburban environments. That's another way that we can address climate change by shifting over to electric platforms for short-range air use and, of course, longer-range use on the ground. And you would have to be more concerned about collision avoidance than traditional flight in low altitude airspace because one would anticipate the number of vehicles in the air is going to increase quite a bit if the system really does get implemented as a means of urban transportation. Now, I would argue that the current transit experience in aircraft is quite terrible, and it probably became more frightening as a result of the pandemic. So I've only been on one flight my entire time in the pandemic. Like, I go on another one tomorrow. But it still is kind of like this. The last flight I went on was pretty packed. So that's obviously something that people don't like, is negative experiences. And so the goal behind urban air mobility type of air travel is that it's a much it's a shared experience, but it's not as chaotic as perhaps commercial air travel. And because you're going over short distances, going between vertiport to vertiport, you don't have sort of like the throngs and throngs of people coming in and out of a large cabin. It's basically four people max in an aircraft for this type of system. So it's more of a, I guess, you know, town car experience versus a cattle car experience, for lack of a better term. And something else which couples really nicely to the transportation space and never before has been thought of in the context of aviation is mobility as a service. So we've all been using that now with ground-based ride shares such as Uber and Lyft and your favorite taxi company on the ground. And there was a pretty big push over the past 4 years where Uber had a division called Uber Elevate, which is the graphic that you see here, where not only could you call a car, but eventually one day you can call an eVTOL to come and pick you up. And there's another company, which I believe is still in existence, Blade, who's already providing helicopter flight services in the New York metropolitan area, for example. So mobility as a service is intended to now cover the future of potentially urban air mobility, eVTOLs in that. Now, Uber Elevate has since been sold, I believe, to Joby, but the division still continues, and obviously Joby has a platform in this space as well, battery-powered for short-range transport and also for potentially for military use cases, as they did receive funding from the Air Force in their development. But once again, you can see here the synergy with AI in terms of traffic management, collision avoidance, and on-demand capability, which is what the customer ultimately wants for this type of experience. But when we talk about advances in transportation, we talk about advances in aviation, we are really talking about the energy infrastructure with renewables to power this green transportation. And whether that comes from wind or from solar, we know that we don't want to use hydrocarbons to provide this electricity. We want to use renewables. And so that is an infrastructure component that has to be developed hand in hand with any shift over to new types of flight using batteries or, for example, hydrogen fuel cells. And so I'm not going to go into too much detail about my company because we're still largely in stealth mode, but ultimately you need renewables to power green transport on the ground as well as on the aircraft. And so when you think about the stored energy that you have on board of an aircraft, it could potentially come from solar panels. That would be a very small plane with an incredibly wide wingspan. It could be provided by batteries, but that aircraft will be very range limited. Obviously, we're already using hydrocarbons, which have good energy density. And I believe the solution for aviation is with hydrogen fuel cells, which has the combination of great electrical efficiency from the electrochemical reaction, as well as the higher energy density that you can get from hydrogen if it's stored in the appropriate form. And then, of course, you have to have access to hydrogen, which then goes back to the infrastructure part. Just like you need to have charging stations if you're going to have electric cars, you also need to have hydrogen fueling stations if you're going to have hydrogen powered planes. It's less of an issue at an airport because there's fewer of them in terms of developing the infrastructure. You can just have fueling trucks just like you do for aviation fuel, but it's something that has to be considered when you bring about a change to an energy infrastructure which couples to a new form of transportation. So why do we want to go electric, though? So whether our stored energy comes from batteries or comes from hydrogen fuel cells creating electricity, electric has a whole bunch of benefits. Obviously, fewer emissions, which is good for the environment. It's also quieter. So if you have an electric motor versus an internal combustion, you know, piston or turbine-driven motor, it's incredibly quiet, and people really care about that in the context of you know, getting somebody to be able to implement a new airport project. Everybody loves to shut down airports because they're noisy. Electric motors, because they have no moving parts, are much higher reliability. So when you think about that in terms of maintenance costs on aircraft, the primary maintenance cost is with the engine, specifically the internal combustion engine. So shifting over to an electric system could be lower cost, which the end user cares about and the operator cares about. And of course, energy efficiency is key. So there's a lot of energy lost in internal combustion engines where they basically are just dissipated as heat. So you can become much more efficient in terms of your ultimate use of energy. But ultimately, carbon footprint is on the rise. We're going to be getting government directives. Europe already has to reduce carbon output. And over time, as cars become electrified, their portion of carbon emissions will go down. And then all of a sudden, the aviation component will increase relative to that over time. So we have to develop the technologies today to decarbonize aviation for the future, because it takes a lot longer to certify a new aircraft or a new aircraft propulsion system as compared to automotive. So these are the reasons why we want to go electric. And as with anything in life, you want to have an evolutionary use case. And so in the case of flight, you want to start with something small. We already have battery-powered drones, for example. And then we can shift over to emergency response vehicles, general aviation aircraft, and even air taxis. I'm going to close my blinds because it's blinding me. Let's see. There we go. That's better. And of course, air taxis is the next one up, and eventually going to regional transport with cargo, probably not jets, probably over to turboprop type planes. But ultimately, at the end of the day, once we get the technology there, we can shift over to jets as well. But understanding your evolutionary use case is kind of key for implementing any new technology, because you can bring in one at a lower capital expenditure, get the market used to it, increase the infrastructure reliance, whether that's charging or hydrogen, and then implement it for larger use cases downstream. So this didn't work before, so I will try sharing my video again. Let's see if this will work. You can let me know if it doesn't. Yeah, it's interesting. For some reason, it was working before, but it's not working now. Oh, well, I won't bother. I will just go back to my slides. Just give me a second. I guess we didn't try it in the other mode before. Okay, so the other element towards sustainability is to think about how we can go from a linear to a circular economy. So a linear economy means you use something and then you generate waste and that's the end of it. A circular economy means that you can find ways to reuse materials. And so when we think about sustainable aviation, we can think about how, well, once our batteries start to degrade for an aircraft, we can't afford that inefficiency, but those batteries could be given to, let's say, ground-based vehicles to use to repurpose. The battery casings themselves could be reused, or they'd be given to people who would use in a terrestrial ground-based environment where they don't care about, you know, the weight of the battery, for example. So if when we think about new technologies that we want to develop, we should think about the carbon footprint for all the materials that go in them and how to reduce the carbon footprint as it goes through its life cycle by reutilizing it in some other way, for example. And I think there are different sectors that are doing a really good job on this, specifically in the cosmetic sector. They're trying to come up with ways to reduce water consumption. And even in the drink sector, like beer companies are coming up with ways to reduce water consumption. And even fabric companies, you know, people who produce clothing are coming up with ways to reduce water consumption. So people are definitely thinking about this now. And so we have to think about how we can implement this into the aerospace sector as well. So what we're looking for ultimately are green technologies to connect our entire planet. So what comes next? Well, what comes next is my favorite thing, which is spaceflight. I spent the majority of my career working on this. And so, you know, there is a conversation underway, you know, what is the business case for space? And I'm sure you heard about that last week or over the past several months with different presentations. But ultimately, we now have different variety of ways of doing suborbital travel. And so what's shown here is Blue Origin on the left, which had its, you know, recent flight with Jeff Bezos just a couple weeks ago. And on the right, Virgin Galactic's spaceship. And so these are intended for space tourism, which is one section of the industry, but they could also be used for travel from point A to point B at incredibly fast speeds. Now you have to ask yourself the question, is the cost sustainable for regular people? Perhaps not. So then it would just be limited to like the people who would fly the Concorde, for example. So you do get economies of scale. And you also have to think about, you know, the environmental footprint. So obviously Blue Origin is using liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen for its propellant and oxidizer, whereas, you know, Virgin Galactic is using a more, you know, traditional noxious propellant choice, which is like a rubber type of material. But these vehicles, at least in the context of Virgin Galactic, you know, have an operational certificate with the FAA, so they can actually sell flights in a commercial venture as a means of making money off of it. And you could see, I would imagine, Virgin as a company would see ways to translate this into an actual transportation system. And then if you go back to science fiction, once again, this has been proposed before in science fiction in terms of suborbital travel as a means of fast-paced travel, you know, across different points on the globe. And I think I heard really recently that William Shatner is going to be going up in the Blue Origin vehicle, once again tying it back to the science fiction regime. So what about after that? Low Earth orbit is clearly next, and that's already happening. You know, obviously it's happened for the U.S. space program with vehicles that were funded by the government, like Space Shuttle and, you know, Apollo, Mercury, Gemini, and then, of course, working with Russia with Soyuz. But now we have our commercial crew vehicle, SpaceX vehicle, that you see here, the Dragon vehicle. And this, I believe, was a development program, you know, from the, you know, 2012 timeframe where they put money into the commercial sector to facilitate access to the International Space Station. First, that was done with cargo flights, and now, of course, it's being done with crewed flights of NASA astronauts, and most recently, a orbital trip around the Earth with a paying space tourist who brought along some additional people with them. So access to low Earth orbit in commercial means for tourism, and I suppose you could say transportation for the International Space Station does exist. We also have another corporate player in this space, which is Boeing with the Starliner capsule, a similar configuration, a similar capacity as they were working to the same, you know, basically call from the U.S. government for the commercial crew vehicle. They're not as far along in the sense that, you know, they've done test flights and they've run into some issues. So clearly SpaceX has a edge on them in terms of the agility of the way the company operates compared to, let's say, a Boeing. But of course, Boeing has tons of experience over the years as a company of all the companies that it's acquired to be able to develop vehicles for this space. And I think I included it, but the Orion vehicle. Yeah, so this is something I spent a little bit of time working on specifically on the capsule aerodynamics and the drogue parachute system. It's very much a souped-up version of Apollo, is what I would call it. And it is intended to not carry people to the International Space Station, but to go beyond that, go beyond low Earth orbit, to be able to take astronauts to the moon and bring them back, take astronauts to Mars and bring them back. And it uses a lot of new technologies, but also a lot of older technologies. So the heat shield, for example, is still EVCO, which was the heat shield material for Apollo. They did investigate other technologies, but in some cases they went with the lower risk approach of something that's been done before. And this, of course, couples to the Artemis program, and it would enable, you know, astronauts to do Earth reentry as a result. I think it's still moving along. I think they've definitely done one flight test, because I saw that a couple of years ago. I just haven't paid attention to what the subsequent flight tests were, and I was more focused on the parachute decelerator system development. And so where does this go next? Well, space flight to and on other planets. Now, people say, oh, we've never flown before on the surface of Mars. Technically, every time you do a Mars entry, descent, landing, you are flying because you are descending through an atmosphere generating aerodynamic drag. And in the context of Mars Science Laboratory, the Curiosity rover, our entry vehicle that you see featured on the left here, did have a lift-to-drag ratio, which means it was generating lift, and that lift vector was modulated with little engines on the back to be able to fly the vehicle basically do bank reversals and have a more extended downrange capability, which ended up, you know, increasing landing accuracy and getting us to a more interesting landing site. So ballistic entries are what has been done up until Mars Curiosity. And then since then, we're doing lifting body entries using an angle of attack on the entry vehicle you see featured here. So it's a very strange looking bird, but it is still an aircraft. And one thing which hasn't yet been attempted is aerodynamic control surfaces, which could be done. You could have trim tabs instead of using ACS thrusters, for example, to be able to modulate your lift. And for some reason, the videos aren't working today, so I can't show you the videos, but that's okay. You can find any of these online. I can always provide the links afterwards for your consumption. Okay. Ugh, now it says it's, sorry, definitely having an issue today with this. So I almost was done with my slides. But yeah, it's giving me some kind of problem because of the videos in there. So the only other thing that I had that I wanted to share was the fact that we've had, you know, another flight extraterrestrially, which is the Mars helicopter. And that occurred over the past several months. And that was the first time that there was sort of an electric flight of a rotorcraft on the surface of another planet. And then we have another mission coming up, which is the Dragonfly mission, which is going to fly an octocopter on Titan and be able to do all kinds of interesting science experiments. And yeah, unfortunately, I have an issue with PowerPoint on my side. When I tried to open that video, it crashed it. So I won't be able to show the very last slide, which I don't think it was that different from it was kind of just a summary slide. So I think I can spend the next, 10, 15 minutes taking questions. And yeah, I apologize. I couldn't show any of those videos. It just didn't work. We tried it earlier and it worked on the two screen mode, but it wasn't working on the single screen mode. So yeah, I think I probably covered everything. The one thing I probably didn't mention just because I felt like I had enough material in there is supersonic flight. So supersonic aircraft, there's several companies in the space who are developing, definitely different from the Concorde, but something that would provide the same Concorde use case. The biggest challenge that's always existed for supersonic flight is the noise signature, which has prevented them from being able to be operated over land masses, which meant they could only do their supersonic transit over bodies of water. I do have a research program at USC where we're looking at mitigating the noise signature of the sonic boom. And there has been a lot of work under development at Boeing and at Texas A&M for shape change technology to also reduce the boom signature as it approaches the ground. And the FAA is looking to update regulations to be able to tolerate more of an acoustic signature, not as much obviously as the Concorde would produce, but would facilitate a supersonic overland travel. And clearly supersonic travel is done for military purposes as well. And what I would say as an entrepreneur is that there's a lot of funding now, which is coming from the Department of Defense, where, small companies such as mine, for example, we actually have an Air Force contract to develop the technology that we're working on with hydrogen fuel cells. Joby, for example, was also funded by an Air Force contract. So there's lots of places now where the defense sector is putting in R&D dollars into ventures in the aviation space, for example, which have both defense uses as well as commercial uses, and they encourage those types of companies to put their ideas forward and get funded. And that's a pretty good model of operation because it allows a lot of companies to get revenue early on and then seek private investment subsequent to that. So I think that pretty much covers everything I wanted to share because I only had one slide afterwards. I won't bother reopening my PowerPoint.
Okay. Thank you very much, Anita, for that. And I'm sure as with all new technologies, we'll eventually figure out a way to make them all work. I just want to make sure that we have a few questions. Again, if you have questions, please put them on the chat. And I'm going to start with a few questions of my own. I think you mentioned this issue of energy density with batteries. I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about kind of the difference between kind of using energy dense fuel like, I don't know, aircraft fuel versus what we can get on batteries today?
Oh, I mean, you know, the same aircraft that could fly 5 hours, you know, from a, you know, gross takeoff weight perspective with aviation fuel could fly at most an hour with batteries. So you can see how it is very range limiting. And there is a certified electric aircraft out there for commercial purposes, which is the Pipistrel Alpha Electro. It's a two-seater. It's a, you know, a sport light aircraft, and it can fly for an hour, basically. So it is only good for training or for, you know, really short range use cases. Obviously, a fixed wing aircraft can't do the urban air mobility job if it needs to land at a vertiport, but it could take you from one small airport to another small airport, you know, within that sort of 1 hour time frame at a cruise speed of, you know, around 100 miles per hour. But yeah, it is a challenge. And I think, you know, people want to be able to translate batteries into aviation because so much investment has been done in batteries over the past, you know, decade to support electric car development programs, but you just can't get to, you know, the specific power or the specific energy that you need with that system.
Was mute. Sorry. The other question that I've seen is there's a lot of trade-offs when we're designing this, and you mentioned systems engineering. So we have trade-offs of energy, materials, avionics, navigation. Which one of these technologies do you think is most critical for building this kind of urban mobility or next generation flight?
Oh, you said avionics or
like advances in. Is it going to be advances in energy storage? Could be batteries or something else, or new materials that we're waiting that will be lighter, I don't know, carbon nanotubes, or is it more about the controls and avionics and, you know, people mentioning like air traffic control for drones or even for low Earth orbit? Which ones are kind of the technologies that you see are as being kind of most critical for this new form of aircraft?
So I would say materials, because materials covers both, you know, lightweighting of structures as well as advances in energy storage. So I think that in general is the life limiter. And for aircraft or for spacecraft, you know, your biggest challenge is mass. So whatever you can do to reduce mass is what you want to do. So having a more efficient propulsion system allows you to reduce mass by carrying less fuel. Having lighter weight structure allows you to reduce mass. So anything which results in a reduction of mass and increase in energy efficiency, I think probably for aircraft controls is not an issue. That being said, if everybody wants to shift over to autonomous flight and no longer having pilots on board, then that would, you know, impose more challenges from a safety and a reliability perspective on the autonomy. So I don't know how far we are away from, you know, the FAA allowing something like that. I would still probably imagine pretty far, but, you know, other countries may allow it sooner than the FAA would. I think probably certainly pilots are worried about it going away. But that being said, you know, there is a pilot shortage. So the pilots would go towards, you know, large jet aircraft, and then maybe these would be autonomy would be focused on these smaller aircraft, which is kind of what is intended here. Yeah, but that's an interesting one with autonomy, because that has always been a push coupled to eVTOL, because these aircraft can't carry much. So the last thing you want is to carry an additional person who isn't a paying passenger.
I guess one of the questions there is, if you want to get started in aviation, do you become a regular pilot, or do you become a certified drone pilot, like what's it, Part 117 or something like that?
Well, you know, interesting thing is that it was a terrible time for commercial pilots during the pandemic just because people stopped flying. But now there's a huge demand for pilots with the appropriate amount of experience. So there won't be any shortage of airline pilot jobs. You just have to be able to get your 1,500 hours to be able to fly them, which is, you know, takes a long time to build that up. But I think there definitely is a new market for people to become drone pilots, you know, for different things like in the, you know, TV industry. People are using them all the time now to collect footage, as well as documentary and news footage. So I think that's probably a whole new sector that people can get into. I think you're on mute.
Okay. So now, I think we have time for, I think, one more question. And I think it's about what you mentioned about your latest venture. Of course, mindful of what you can reveal and what you can't. But what is so interesting about hydrogen as relates to aviation versus other forms of other fuels, like biofuels or things like that?
Well, so the goal for shifting to hydrogen for both cars or for aircraft is to eliminate your carbon footprint, because a hydrogen fuel cell, or if you combust hydrogen with oxygen in a chemical sense, your product is water. So water vapor is your exhaust. And so, you know, water vapor has a much shorter time, residence time in the atmosphere. It's not a greenhouse gas like CO2 is. So that's the primary reason why, is for sustainability reasons. That being said, the other primary reason is energy efficiency. So the most efficient rocket you can get from a specific impulse perspective is using liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So that gives you the most chemical energy of any propellant combination you can come up with. So from an electrochemical perspective, a hydrogen fuel cell is also incredibly efficient from a specific power perspective. The challenge with hydrogen, of course, is that it can't really be stored as a gas, because you have to store it at really high pressure, then you have to have really heavy tanks. So you want to be able to store it in a different form, whether that's liquid or chemically bonded. And that's the way you can get around the fact that it's incredibly low density as a gas, but you can store it in a more efficient way so that you can benefit from the energy efficiency of the electrochemical reaction between the hydrogen and the oxygen. And doing chemical is different from doing electrochemical, but both are incredibly efficient.
Excellent. So, okay, I'm off mute. I think we're almost out of time. But Anita, thank you very much. This has been great. It's great to see you again. And everybody else, thank you very much for coming to the presentation. You should expect to see on an email shortly a list of attendance, and perhaps we'll put some of the links to the videos that we can show today. Anyways, Anita, thank you very much. Thank you everybody for coming. I think Ivan, unless we have anything else, I think we are done for today. And thank you very much everybody for attending, and see you soon.